Okay, for those of you who do have the sheets, in case the title was completely confusing, where it says Akedah Yitzchak and then parentheses or parenthetically and Yishmael with a question mark next to Yishmael.
That's the Arab.
Excuse me?
That's
the Arab. Maybe. Why do you say that?
Okay.
Maybe. Okay, we'll see. You know what? I'll talk about that for a second. First, I'll tell you what I won't speak about. I won't speak about politics, and I won't speak anything that happened in the last 3,000 years. Okay? So, we're going back to far. And there's a couple of different ways of doing this. And you know what? Not only, you know, when certain people hear this topic, the first thing that comes to the mind is perhaps I am speaking about the supposed Arab perspective on the Akedah that Yishmael was really the one who was offered. And I've heard many times that that's what it says in the Quran. There's only one problem with that, and that is that it does not say that in the Quran. Okay, so in the Quran, actually, the child of Abraham who was offered is anonymous. And that leaves it up to the reader to then to determine which child it is. Is it Yitzchak or is it Yishmael? Then the Mefarshim, the commentaries, and not necessarily the first generation of them either, commentaries of the Quran then read into it and say that this is Yishmael, but we're not talking about that. So you can take that and you can place it aside. What we are going to do today is to do a comparison between chapter 21 and chapter 22. So again, the one thing, though, which is interesting about the anonymity of the one who was sacrificed in the Quran, right, not Yishmael, that it's anonymous, the one thing about that is that may very well parallel something within the Tanakh, which we will see as we go on. But as I said, that's as far as I'm even going to consider that. This topic itself, trying to compare chapter 21, which is really the separation of Yishmael, taking Yishmael and thrusting him outside of Abraham's tent, which of course we have to appreciate is incredibly ironic, if that's the right word. Avraham's tent was an inclusive tent. Avraham's tent was a tent which stood and took people in. And over here, we have a situation where Avraham is basically forced. He does not seem to be particularly pleased with this, but Avraham is forced to take this child and to send him away. And whether there's a price to be paid for that is something which we will consider later on. This the research that I did for this, just in case you want to copy this, the first thing that I did was I sat and I compared chapter 21 and chapter 22. After I finished my comparisons, I read a whole bunch of things, and I think that I had found myself all of what I was looking for. But the first person who really did serious work on this is Professor Uriel Simon, who did have a political agenda involved. Excuse me? There was a political agenda involved, so over here, this is without it. I actually have a very useful book for anybody interested in the Akedah at home. It's called Akedah Yitzchak Lizaro, for future generations, Mabat Be'ayin Be'ein Yisraelit, looking at it through an Israeli eye. And it's a book which, fortunately, is in the memory of somebody who had passed away or somebody who was killed during his military service. His name was Yitzchak, which is why they chose this topic. Yitzchak Hirschberg, who was killed in 1982 in the war in Lebanon. And the book has a collection of incredible amount, varied articles. Anybody who wants to spend time on Akedah Yitzchak, this is the book that you should purchase if you could work through the Hebrew and go through. There's also an article on how Akedah Yitzchak has been used as a political symbol in terms of Arabs and Jews, in terms of the whole Akedah Ishmael, and that we also will not be dealing with, but as I said, it's interesting. And also, just in case you're wondering, the quote in the very beginning from Bob Dylan is not really relevant, but it amused me. So I will at least read it. Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. And that has nothing to do with anything else we said today. But and those of you who need to know who Bob Dylan is, please come over afterwards. And you know what? I was going to put his Hebrew name there. If I would have put his Hebrew name, then nobody would have had a chance. Okay. That's not just his Hebrew name, right? The one they would call him up to the Torah with. Okay. Enough. V'Hashem pakad et Sarah. What we're going to do, and all that we're going to do today, is read these 21 verses. That's what we're going to do. Now, here's what you need to keep in mind. We could read them, as I said, because you have a political agenda. We're not doing that. We could read them because we want to study Sefer Bereshit. We're not really doing that. We're reading this and comparing and contrasting with the next chapter for a very simple reason. Because we're a couple days before Rosh Hashanah, and on Rosh Hashanah, on the first day, we're going to read chapter 21. On the second day, we're going to read chapter 22. And it could very well be that from your perspective, these are two completely independent, separate chapters, have nothing to do with one another. But what we may see, and I'll tell you right now, that's not what we may see. What we will see is that the interaction between the two, the parallels, the contrasts, the intersections is probably a better term, is one that will leave us, that by the time we're finished, that all we're going to have to ask ourselves, okay, so what is the meaning of the interconnections? Not so much is it there or not. It'll be very obvious that it's there, but we need to look at things perhaps with a different eye. Now, when I say that there are comparisons, it doesn't necessarily mean that we have identical information, because it's not the same story. One is a story of a child being sent away, and one is a story of a child ostensibly going to be offered or sacrificed. Those are two different stories. But there are many things along the way which we will see are similar. From the very beginning is an opposite, actually. But it's the opposite that needs to be taken into consideration. V'Hashem pakad et Sarah. Which name of God is used over here? Hashem. And what does Hashem mean for us? It means rachamim. It means compassion. Is that a surprise at all? Which means the starting point of this chapter, which as far as we can tell, on Rosh Hashanah, which is Yom HaZikaron, this really could have been enough. And we have a tradition, in fact, that Yitzchak is born on Rosh Hashanah, right? There are other traditions also, by the way. But we have a tradition that he's on Pesach, right? There's also a tradition. Or, alternatively, not that he was born in Rosh Hashanah, we have another tradition, Hashem, that conceived, right? He was conceived on Rosh Hashanah, and that's when Yom HaZikaron, that is when Sarah is remembered. And as Sarah is remembered, so all of us are remembered in a similar positive way on Rosh Hashanah. But we note, as I said, in this first verse, we have the name of God, Yud He Vav He, which, again, in Jewish tradition means, or indicates, God's wearing his hat of compassion. V'Hashem pakad et Sarah kasher amar, v'yas Hashem l'Sarah kasher diber. Used twice within this first verse, not to be used again the rest of the chapter. Incidentally, now if you turn over, and you have to keep on doing this, all day, you're going to have to keep on doing this. If you turn over to the Akedah, it begins in an opposite sense. V'yiyachar drim ha'ele, v'elokim nisat Avraham. The starting point for the Akedah is the other way around. The starting point is the name of God being utilized is Elohim. Elohim is Midat Hadin. So over here, in a sense, right from the starting point, we have two very different stories. The one which we're starting with, the story of an elderly woman who's postmenopausal, who finds herself pregnant, which could be a big surprise. That's not within the Rosh Hashanah greetings for anyone here, but really is a story of something going, and I'm using Sarah's words, from death to life. What does she say? After my body is withered, will I be with child? Which means over here we have a miracle of going literally from death to life, and that's what tshuva is. Tshuva is that when a person is able to take the parts of their lives which really are negative, which really are destructive, which really should lead in a certain direction, and that gets flipped around and turned into life. That's a perfect theme for Rosh Hashanah, which means it's not just the fact that God remembers Sarah. It's what he remembers her and the topic of remembering her, and suddenly there's life. The name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei is very significant in terms of tshuva, and that's why in Yom Kippur we get to Lefnei Hashem Titaru. The name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei is a name which transcends time, space, and matter. It's really God on God's terms. What does the name mean? Was, is, and will be. So what does that mean? That means eternal. Which means to be eternal, suddenly the past is not all that significant. Which is, if you just think about that miracle, how can it possibly be that if I did something yesterday, I can have the best lawyer in the world, but if I did something yesterday, I still did it. Correct? If somebody committed murder yesterday, they committed murder. How can tshuva possibly work? How can they stand in front of God? Because if God transcends time, and the relationship with God at this particular moment is one which is completely sincere, I'm not talking about implications of an action. I'm going to get to that before we finish today. But if an individual stands in front of God, and God is outside of time, so suddenly the past is no longer significant. It's right now is more real than anything else. And that's why the name of God is used over here in the very beginning. And that's why this particular name of God is used, by the way, with all korbanot, only this name is used. And that's why this name is used on Yom Kippur, Lefnei Hashem Titaru. If you're standing in front of God, then suddenly purity is possible. Because all of you can say, how can purity be possible if a person has a whole host of sins? Lefnei Hashem Titaru. And that's really the resolution, standing in front of God. But that's where the story sort of shifts directions. Second verse, Vatahar Vatelet Sarala Avraham Ben, the Zekunav, Lemoed Asher Diber Ito Elokim. And that's very interesting. Because over here, already the name Elokim is introduced, which you'll all have to try to figure out, why is Elokim in this verse? Apparently, that Avraham and Sarah should have a child is something which God decided based upon Midat Hadin, which this is based upon fairness, not just upon compassion. The fact that it happened when they're elderly, they're God's compassion. But over here, the name Elokim is introduced, and will continue throughout the story. Vayikra Avraham et Shem Beno Hanoladlo, Asher Yoldadlo Sarah Yitzchak. He's called Yitzchak, which, by the way, is laughter, but future-oriented laughter. Verse 4, you think I'm going to go quick, right? It'll slow down soon. Vayamal Avraham Yitzchak bino ben shmonat yamim kasher tziva oto Elokim. Avraham circumcised his son, Yitzchak, as he was commanded by God. And what is that foreshadowing of? That's foreshadowing the Akedah. Which means over here, Avraham takes a knife to his child. Okay? Again, just think about it. Over here, Avram takes a knife, not just to his child, to an 8-day-year-old child who was never done before. This is the first 8-day-year-old child who is being circumcised. Avram takes a knife to the child, and who commanded it? Kasher tzivoto? Elokim. Which means Avraham's experience, as this is going on, must have been one which is really quite difficult. Did he ever dream that that's just, you know, the entree? We didn't get to the main course yet. Yeah. That he did dream. I don't know if he dreamed at this point, but it could be that at the moment that he's doing this, he's thinking to himself, you know, God forbid that I should ever draw blood from my child again, and never, you know, again, in his wildest dreams, would think that it can ever escalate from this particular point. But over here, again, the name of God being used by this particular command is Elokim, and as I said, now that I've pointed out, but that's the very next chapter, you almost can't ignore it and realize that this really is foreshadowing for what's going to take place almost immediately afterwards. Good? Good. V'Avram ben Miat Shana b'Yivaled Lo Yitzchak b'No. Avram's 100 years old. And you know which word is interesting in that verse? Beno, his son. You notice it's also in the previous verse. Vayivol Avram et Yitzchak Beno, his son. Because it could have just said it Yitzchak. You already know who Yitzchak is. We were just introduced. It does. The text doesn't have to emphasize verse after verse over here, Beno, his son. There may be some foreshadowing here as well with that usage. The Thomas Saritzchok Asali Elokim, Kol HaShemei Yitzchak Li. And again, notice Elokim. Notice that the perspective of Avraham and Yitzchak is that God has judged. Again, you think about, at times, I would use the word tragedy, of the couple who are infertile, unable to bring children, and when finally the child comes, they're not looking at it, oh, God did Yudke Vavke. They're saying, why shouldn't we have a child like everyone else? They're using the word Elohim here, both of them, which, as I said, is quite interesting. Verse 7 then goes into poetry. Vatomer, mi milel Avraham hanika banim sara ki yaladati ben lizakunav. Verse 8. V'yigadal hayeled, the child got older. V'yigamal, and he was weaned. Vayas Avram mishte gadol biyom higamel Yitzchak. He made a big party. Verse 9. Vatera sara et ben hagar hamitzrit. Asher yolda la'Avraham mitzachek. She sees the child of Hagar. Oh, what's his name? So I can assure you now for the rest of his chapter, his name is never used. Not once. So I said, the anonymity that the Quran has regarding the Akedah actually is not, by the Akedah, it's very clear which son. It's Yitzchak. But over here, you do have, and his name is not used throughout the entire text, and that itself is interesting. Why would a name not be used? So, as I said, there you can offer your own answers, but my suspicion would be that if a name is not used, it really lowers the level of the significance of the individual. I mean, everybody has a name. Over here, the name is not even used. And you see the contrast of Yitzchak Beno versus over here, and again, this is the perspective of who right now? It's Sarah. Vatera Sarah et ben Hagar hamitzrit. Asheil dala Avraham mitzachek. It's not ben Avraham. It's the son of this woman that happened to have been born to Avraham. Now again, the truth is that Sarah may bear some responsibility for all this. Of course, the moral of the story is when your wife tells you to sleep with someone, the right answer is no. Okay? Unless it's her. Okay? Just in case anyone needs marital advice, this seems like definitely the place. Okay. Vatomer la'Avraham, and yes, my wife is here, don't worry. Vatomer la'Avraham, garesh ha'mahazot, she says to Avraham, chase away this ama. What does the word ama mean? Servant. Now, whether Hagar has the status of a wife or as a servant is also an important subtext, and there's a lack of consistency going all the way through the various times that she is mentioned, that she appears. The fact that Sarah calls her a servant should not be a big surprise, because how does she introduce to us from the very beginning? As a servant of Sarah, which means as far as Sarah is concerned, that's what she is, that's who she is, that's who she will always be. Right. She is lowering the status of Hagar and by extension of her son, who's not even mentioned. And it says that he was mitzachek. I can assure you that if you look in the commentaries, in the Midrashim, in the commentaries, you will find Yishmael at this point being guilty of every conceivable crimes and a couple that you never even thought of. They throw the book at him over here, which is again, very typical of Chazal, which has its theory of conservation of characters. It has its good characters, its bad characters. Its good almost can't do wrong, and its bad almost can't do good. And over here, what does he do? He's mitzachek. What is mitzachek? Is he making fun? Of course, you have to notice that Yitzchak's name is Yitzchak, and mitzachek, and therefore should be extension, which means this easily could have been, oh, look, how much laughter is in the world. Even Ishmael is happy and laughing, but apparently there's something attacking within his laughter. There's something which is challenging. There's something which Sarah doesn't particularly like. Later on in Parshat Toldot, it will say, what is it exactly, the verse? Eile Toldot Avraham, right? And then it will say, Avraham Lidat Yitzchak. And Rashi over there says that Leitzanei Hador, I always love that term, right? There are a lot of people I want to give bumper stickers to, okay? It says Leitzanei Hador. What does Leitzanei Hador mean? The joke. It doesn't mean the stand-ups. It means the jokers of the generation. Leitzanei Hador said that. Excuse me. The clowns. Leitzanei Hador said, "How is it possible that an old man like Avraham could have fathered Yitzchak?" Therefore, Rashi says, "Oh, he looked just like Avraham." So, therefore, to take away that argument, so over here again, theory of conservation of late Sanim. So Yitzchak's mitzachek, the Midrash also says that he also challenged the paternity, and said that there's no way in the world that Yitzchak, there's no way in the world that Yitzchak is really a child, which really, that becomes a very interesting subtext, if that's a correct reading here, because the whole issue that's going to follow is who really is a legitimate child. She sees this, V'tomer la'Avraham, Pasuk Yud, Garesh ha'amah hazot v'et bana, ki lo yirash ben ha'amah hazot im bini im Yitzchak. So again, very clear. The ben, the son, is Yitzchak. He's there by name. He is Sarah's son. He is Avraham's son. But this other child isn't even named. He will not be one who will inherit together. Vayira hadavar ma'od be'en Avraham alodot b'no. You notice what phrase it uses here. Avraham sees this child as his son. Correct. He sees Ishmael as a son. Sarah sees him as something less. That is the tension in the Avraham Avinu, Sarah Imenu household, right? And it's great when you have friends above. Vayomer Elokim, again, Midat Hadin. Vayomer Elokim El Avraham, Al Yera Be'enecha, Al Hana'ar va'al Amatecha. Now, which way did God just decide? What does God just now call Hagar? Your servant. Right? What does he call Hana'ar? You realize he could have used a different word. Right, he could have said your son. The child, which you realize is much more quote unquote parv. Kol asher tamar elecha Sarah shema bekola, ki biYitzchak yikare lecha zara. Yitzchak will ultimately be the one who will be your progeny. Where do we see this issue played out in the next chapter? Turn the page. It's right there at the beginning. Vayihi achar dvirma eile, vayelokim nisat Avraham, vayoma ilav Avraham, vayoma hineni, vayoma kachna et bincha, et yichidcha, asher hafta et Yitzchak. Right, which means, over here to stress, your son, you're only the son, the one that, it's Yitzchak, which means that's not a surprise, because we've already seen that before. Which means, again, the taking of Yitzchak is not independent of what's taking place right over here in terms of trying to figure out who is the real heir, who is the real son, even. And again, you can't help but read that verse and realize, you know, how God used language. Again, al yera be'enecha al hanar va'al amatecha. It could have easily have said Yishmael and Hagar. It easily could have said your son and your wife. That's not used. But again, the end of that verse is, in verse 12, you bet, listen to Sarah, for B'Yitzchak Yikra Lecha Zara. He is your progeny. He is your heir. And then, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, V'gam et ben ha'ama l'goy asimenu ki zar'acha hu. Which you can now decide is absolutely contradictory. But again, look how carefully it said, I will also make the son of the servant into a great nation, because he also carries your genes. Right? Which means there's a difference between Kizaracha, who he has your DNA, versus saying he is your heir. Which means the tension over here between these two verses, you now realize what the topic really is till this point is, who is the real heir of Avraham? And Sarah knows, God knows, and Avraham knows. And then God says something, Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah, shma bekola, anything that Sarah says, you should listen to her, right? Which is why I didn't marry a woman named Sarah. Okay, let's move on, because then there's no divine. Okay, let's go to pasuk Yudalid. Vayashkem Avraham baboker. Okay, did that remind you of anything? Okay, those of you keeping note, you see in pasuk Gimel, Vayashkem Avraham baboker. Same exact phrase. Avram gets up early. Continue. Pasuk Yudalit, Vayashkem Avraham baboker, Vayikach lechem v'chemat mayim. He takes bread and water. Vayitain el hagar sam al shechma, and he places it on her back. Vayetayelad v'yishalcheha v'telech v'teta b'midbar be'er shava. Are you guys getting good at this yet? Any other connections in this pasuk Yudalit with the next chapter? Beersheba is a connection, because Beersheba is where they will end up at the very end of the story. The other part is actually a very interesting contrast. The things which are taken in the other chapter, what does he take with him? He takes instruments of destruction. Over here, he takes instruments of life. Which means, I'm not sure if we should call it a Akedat Yishmael or what you want to call it. In the expulsion of Yishmael, Avraham comes prepared with supplies, things to live, while in the chapter dealing with the Akedah, there's only instruments of death. You have the fire, the wood, and ultimately we'll see the knife. There's another part that we may have missed. V'yitain el hagar sam al shichma. What does shichma mean? He puts it on the shoulder. Later on, in pasuk vav, in perikov bet, v'yikach Avram et etzei ha'ola v'yasem al Yitzchak b'no. He takes the wood and he puts it on Yitzchak's back or shoulder, however it were. It doesn't say, but he puts it on top of him. Which, by the way, I can assure you that all Christological sources understand the significance of that, that Yitzchak is bearing his cross as he goes towards his crucifixion, as it were. And not only is that in Christological sources, it happens to be in ancient Midrashim as well, which, by the way, may very well be where they got the idea from, but there are Midrashim that even use the word tzaluv in the Midrash. And anybody... I will try not to do this more than once today, but some of you may have noticed that my representative, my publisher, is upstairs, and they're selling the book on Bereshit. So there, I do have a footnote about this at some point. I don't remember where, but I do have a footnote over here. You can buy the book, and we'll have food for Rosh Hashanah. Okay, let's continue. But now you realize that this is also a direct comparison. They start wandering near the desert Beersheba. That is where that is the place that Avraham heads towards after the Akedah at the very end of the story. Pasuk Tetvav. V'yichlu amayim min hachemat. The water is finished. V'tashlech etayah, which is very interesting, because the name is Tashlech, right? Which actually, on a midrashic level, is connected with Avraham's travel to the Akedah. There is a whole connection there that the Satan came and created some kind of a river, and Avraham also drowned it. Those of you who try to find a source for Tashlech, you will find that midrash which is quoted Anyway, v'tashlech et hayeled tachad achad hasichim. She throws the child underneath one of the bushes. So does that connect to anything for us? Correct. Correct. We have the sichim and we have the svach. If you will, we have the shrubs and the thicket. I'm not sure how much of it, but again, you realize that there is a similar theme in both stories. There is one critical difference over here, and the critical difference is what we see in the next verse, Tet Zayin, Vatelech vateshav la mineged harchek kimat chavei keshet, ki amra al erev mot hayeled. She goes and stands at a distance, the distance of a bow, because she doesn't want to see the death of the child. By the way, this sounds very much like the famous Talmudic passage that will one day be taught afterwards, where Rabbi Akiva and Ben Peturah speak about two people going in the desert with one thing of water, where Ben Peturah's argument that one should not see the death of the other, that is exactly the logic of Hagar. I do not want to see the death of Yishmael. Vateshev mineged, vatisa kola vatefk, which basically means she took the child, threw him away, and gave up, and said, he's going to die, I just don't want to be around to see it. Avraham never really gives up in the Akedah, and Avraham keeps there, you know, he's there all the way to the end, which may actually be a crucial difference. What happens next? She cries, but Pasuk Yud Zayin says, V'yishma Elokim, and we do have to know which name of God is used here. Elokim midat hadin. V'yishma Elokim et kol hanar, v'yikra malach Elokim el hagar min hashamayim, v'yomer la malach hagar al tir'i ki shama Elokim el kol hanar basher husham. God hears the cry of the child, of the boy. An angel of God calls out to Hagar from heaven saying, what's going on, Hagar? God has heard the sound of the child where he is. Is this paralleled at all to the story of the Akedah? Right? It's almost, you can't say anything else. Of course it is. But again, there's a comparison and there's a contrast. What is the comparison or what is the similarity? Okay, good. So we have, first of all, at the moment when we think that death is going to arrive, we have a word from our sponsor, right? At that moment, an angel comes, again, really, at the moment, what?
Huge difference in response. Hagar goes away, and Avram stays there and does what he's supposed to.
I said that, correct, so I agree with you, right? That's a good way to get me to agree every time, right? Correct, but now something else has happened. We've gone right past that. The voice comes from heaven, and one difference between these voices are they're both angels, but one is a malach Elokim, and one is a malach Yudke Vavke. Which is which? For Yitzchak, it is a malach of Yudke Vavke, which means the starting point of the Akedah was Elokim Nisa et Avraham, correct? And now, Yudke Vavke, compassion has come in and interjected. By the story of Yishmael, it's the starting point of the whole story was really Yudke Vavke, and now Elokim comes in, or Malach Elokim comes in and speaks. One thing which is, I think, particularly interesting is that Hagar cries and Yishmael cries, and it says that God hears the voice of the child. Did the child cry to God? And the reason why I think this is so significant is because I do want to remind you that we're talking about this because we're going to read this in Rosh Hashanah. This is going to be part of the Rosh Hashanah liturgy, right? Kriyat HaTorah and Rosh Hashanah is going to be this section. Here we have somebody crying and God responding. What you have to note is that the one who's crying is not even necessarily crying to God, which therefore we still need to answer. So why is God getting involved at this point? And not only that, just so you can help me a little bit, which name of God is used here? Elohim. So it's Midat Hadin. So therefore, why is God getting involved at this point? Because, again, there's only one answer you can give. That this is justice.
The child doesn't deserve to die.
Which means the death of the child would be unjust. The saving of the child is divine justice, which then you have to move back a step and ask yourself, so what about getting rid of the child? Was that necessarily just, or was that unjust? And if you really want, and here's where you can begin to accuse me of getting involved in politics, but I'm not. Here you can begin to ask yourself the really frightening question, and that is the Akedah in any level, Avraham, right? And after these things, God tested Avraham. Is the Akedah in any sense, I would say Tag Machir, but then I'd completely get in trouble if I said that. Is it in any way a divine payback where God is basically saying, oh, you think throwing away somebody's son is an easy thing? How about you trying this right now? Which means what I'm raising the question. You're saying it's not fair. God said, listen to Sarah. Doesn't mean that Sarah's wife. Doesn't mean that she's right. I understand everything you're going to say to me. God agrees that the progeny... God agrees that the child who will inherit Avraham is not Yishmael. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you send him off to die. Okay? Those are separate things. Which means, as we're reading this, and as we notice all the connections, that is the frightening question you have to ask yourself. Is the divine command to Avraham, take your child, take the one that you love, take your son, and take him out and kill him, or offer him as an offering on one of the mountains that I will show you, is that at all connected to the very previous chapter where there is a child who is the victim of abuse? One second. You know what? If I will bring this into a contemporary issue, it won't be politics. It will be education. Why get rid of Yishmael? He's a bad influence on Yitzchak. Even though, by the way, the Torah never said that. You're looking at Midrashim. How many kids get kicked out of school because they may be a bad influence on the other kids or whatever it is? Good, you kicked out that kid. Now what? Now what happens to that kid? What's he supposed to do now? I'm saying that is a plague in this country. There's an absolute plague, taking kids and kicking them out. Okay, so here you have a divine answer to that, where God says, I don't like that behavior. Let's continue. Yeah. All that I'll ask you to do is to go back and to read the words, what God agrees and what he didn't say. Which means you're assuming that everything that follows, therefore, is part of what God told him. It's not necessarily the case. Again, I need to stress one thing, and this is the piece of evidence we're working with. It doesn't say that Ishmael is saved because of God's compassion, but rather because of justice. And that is the Malach Elohim getting introduced. I'm going to make him into a great nation. By the way, you go back now and compare that to the Akedah. But the Akedah you also have at the very end, after the child is saved, you also have a blessing being introduced. And the blessing that is received by Avraham or / Yitzchak is a much broader blessing. In fact, it sounds like a conglomeration of all the blessings that Avraham has received at various points. What verse is that? Ki barecha verechecha, that's from the very beginning. Vaharbe arbe et zarecha kechochvei shamayim, that's another blessing received, right? Right? It's another blessing he receives. Over here, it all comes together, but it's not the same blessing as Yishmael. What is Yishmael's blessing that he gets at the end? Which is actually exactly what Avram was told from the very beginning. Verse 19, chapter 21. And God opens her eyes. What does that mean? That she sees something. Does that occur by the Akedah? But you saw Avram et Einav. By the way, there's a difference between the two. Avraham sees, but she needs her eyes opened up. It may be parallel to when Avraham has three people coming, we're told they're anashim. But when Lot sees the two people coming, there the word malachim is used. So apparently, Avraham treats his guests as malachim and doesn't need to know that they're malachim. But Lot, in order to get special treatment from Lot, you need to look like a malach. The eyes are opened up, batira ber mayim, which means when the opening of the eyes is where ultimately the salvation will come from. Water then appears, vatelech v'tmalei et chimata mayim v'tashket anar, and therefore the child is saved. When Avram opens up his eyes or lifts up his eyes, what does he see? He sees an aisle, and the aisle therefore will take the place of the child, and therefore Yitzchak will be saved, and we will have a situation of transference where the divine mandate will now be shifted, and now the offering will be the aisle and not Yitzchak. Vayihi Elohim etanar vayigdal vayeshev vamidbar. It's interesting that after his brush with death, he becomes somebody who plays with weapons of death. He plays with bows and arrows. And his mother found for him a bride, which, by the way, you realize is the same thing really with Yitzchak, where his father sees to it that he gets a child, which is really the continuation, but there's a couple of scenes in between it. And the next time, incidentally, that we find Yitzchak after the Akedah is where? In source number 3, Vayihi ba mibo be'er l'chai ro'i, which is actually, it's the place where Hagar had her vision, but it's interesting, it's be'er l'chai ro'i. It's one of life. That Yitzchak afterwards goes towards life, and Yishmael embraces something which is towards death. Okay, and by the way, and I told you, maybe we do this one at a time, I do have a whole chapter on Yitzchak by Be'er L'chai Ro'i, why he went there, what he was trying to accomplish there, what was the agenda. Okay, let's now try to figure everything else out. At this point, if I were to say to you that I suspect that there's some kind of a connection between chapters 21 and 22, would you tend to agree with me? Okay, so the hard part we've already done, and all that we're left with now really is then to try to understand, okay, so what is the significance? Let's start with chapter 22. And again, I'm not reading the Akedah the same way that I would if I was reading the Chumash on a regular day, or if I was studying Chumash, or for that matter, if I was studying Sefer Bereishit, or was the Parashat HaShavuah. I'm looking at the Akedah through the prism of a Rosh Hashanah experience. So suddenly a minor character becomes the major character. And what's that? That's the ram. And the ram's horn becomes something which is a major feature of the story. That's one thing. Does anybody remember the verse that we say immediately before we blow the shofar? Immediately before. I'll take a look at source number 5. Allah Elokim b'truah, Hashem b'kol shofar. So now that we've been working for around 40 minutes, and we're going to move towards an end, what do you see in that verse? You see din and rachamim, but what else do you see? You see the din being shifted into rachamim, which means the judgment. Allah Elokim, Elokim is God's name, judgment. Allah Elokim bitruah, that when we blow the shofar, what is going to take place? We're going to take midat hadin, and we're going to flip it into midat harachamim, and compassion. The story of the Akedah begins, Elokim nisa et Avraham midat hadin, and what happens when Avraham is willing to serve God? What happens at that point? Then Malach Hashem comes from min Hashemayim, and therefore the story of the Akedah is the successful transformation of midat hadin into midat rachamim, which that's why I said again, the Akedah could be read on so many different levels, but when we read on Rosh Hashanah, that's the story of the Akedah. Got it? Changing, and by the way, changing from din to rachamim really is the shift from death to life, which means the Midrash, when it tells us beautifully, and it's connected to that the first three brachot in Shemoneh Esrei are called the Avot. So Magen Avraham is connected to Avraham. The second bracha is connected to Yitzchak. The Midrash says, when did Yitzchak make this bracha? When he got off of the Mizbeach. He got off the Mizbeach. What bracha did he say? Baruch Ata Hashem, Mechayei Hametim. Listen, having a knife to your throat can be a traumatic experience, correct? But therefore, the Midrash is understanding that we've just now have gone from death to life. And that, in a sense, is what we want to accomplish in Rosh Hashanah. If, God forbid, there is a strict judgment which is hovering about, we want to turn that strict judgment into rachamim. So now, we've pushed aside the Akedah. I don't think anyone has ever pushed aside the Akedah as quickly as I just now did. So now we're left with, but what is the religious significance specifically on Rosh Hashanah, with the expulsion of Yishmael? So I want to stay on one phrase, which you have in source number 6, V'Yishmael Elokim et Kol Hanar, and the very end of the, and that's the moment where judgment comes in and Yishmael is saved. Which, of course, by the way, you realize that even though his name isn't mentioned, God hears him. If God hears him, the name Yishmael is such an apt name. I mean, there's no other place where the name is deserving as much as in this particular context, even though, as I mentioned, his name is not here at all. God hears him. But at the very end it says, Et kol hana'ar ba'asher hu sham. Ba'asher hu sham. Rashi writes in source number 7, Basher Husham, where he's at. That would be the vernacular. Where he's at. Lefima asim shuose achshav hu nadun velo lefima shu atid lasot. That God judges him on what he's at now and not on the things that he's going to do later on. The Gur Aryeh, and those of you not familiar, is the Maharal from Prague, who wrote what's called a super commentary. He wrote a commentary on a commentary. The Maharal's Gur Aryeh is a commentary on Rashi, and dealing with this Rashi, where Rashi writes, Lefi oto sha'a, the Maharal writes, V'lo kashmi ben sora umora shehu nidon al shem sofo. And don't go asking questions about the ben sora umora who's judged for what he will do. And you know what? Even though he told me not to compare it, that's a real good question. Why do we have a parasha in the Torah where we're told if a child acts inappropriately, whatever all the criteria may be, he's then put to death as a ben sora umora? Why over here does Rashi say that no, this child is judged by Sher Husham and not as ben sora umora? He then offers one answer that he quotes from the Ra'im, from the Mizrahi, which he doesn't like. He says the difference over here is that the ben sora umora started to quote-unquote go off the derech, and Yishmael had not, which, by the way, is against the number of Midrashim. And then the Maharal gives his own answer, and he says something which is very counterintuitive. He says the heavenly court operates in different ways than the earthly court. The heavenly court treats you by what you've done now. The earthly court will treat you, say, hold it, by what you will. So he gets stuck right there. He gets stuck. He then says, well, it must be that the earthly court follows the Torah. And the Torah says, if a child's been sora mora, this is the punishment. Which means, I just have to point out the irony. God knows what's going to be in the future. And the heavenly court does not utilize that information. Here's a question that came up, that was debated. It's actually debated between two rabbis of Prague. One was the Maharal, and the other was the Noda Behuda. And this is an impossible question, but it's relevant. What if somebody committed a crime, pick your crime, and then comes to the court and says, you know what, I'm really sorry. Do we believe that tshuva works? So if tshuva works, then why can't they say in front of the judge, listen, I'm really sorry. Pick the crime. Somebody was mechalel Shabbos, somebody murder, whatever the crime may be. There were two witnesses, and he comes in front of the court and says, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry. So what, if we believe in tshuva, so why can't the court say, oh, you're sorry, okay, so go home, that's fine. Right? The no to be Yehuda says, the only reason we don't do it is because we don't really know what's in his heart. Being that we don't know what he really thinks, so it's not admissible evidence. That's what the Nohu Debuta says. His feelings right now are not admissible. We can only base ourselves on actions, but if we really would know, then we would do it. The Maharal gives a different answer. The Maharal says no. He says it's the Nativa Tshuva, which you have in the last source over here. He says, because Midat HaTshuva Kasher Yitchareta Adam Yavonotav Shasav V'shav L'Shem Tiprach B'chol Libo Va'al Yitma Adam Yeze Ta'am Yo'il HaTshuva Achar Shekver Chata V'ri Bebeitin Shomata Acharei Shasav Chet Shechayav Mita Af She'anu Yodim Shekver Shav B'tshuva Einu Patur Min HaMita. That in a court below, that even if we know he's sincere, we can't do it. Because the court below follows actions, not thoughts. The Noda B'Yehuda disagrees. The Noda B'Yehuda says on this point, if we knew, then of course we would let the guy off the hook. But the Maharal apparently feels the earthly court follows actions. But it's interesting because the heavenly court does have an awareness what's going to be. And here we're told, lo, God judges Basher Husham. So let's pause on this and think about this for a second. It means on Rosh Hashanah, and it goes back to my point that I said in the beginning, Lifnei Hashem, Yom Kippur is about being in front of God. Dirshu Hashem bihi matzo. During the 10 days of tshuva, we search out God when God is accessible. On these days, there is more of an awareness of God. There's more of a feeling of God. I don't know if it's the tunes from the Beit Knesset, or maybe the smells of the kitchen. But Rosh Hashanah is a time that God is close. It's a time that there's a certain feeling of the holiday. During this feeling, when we are in front of God, that is reality. The fact that you may do something else in the future is not relevant. The same way that I said before, the past isn't relevant. What we learn over here from this Rashi is, no, God judges us, but asher hu sham, that right now, where you are right now, that is what's significant. Which means when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, a person needs to stand in front of God and say, you know, here I am right now, this is what I want. And you know, some of us could get, you know, a little cynical and say, every year the same thing, every year I say the same things, every year I say I'm gonna make a bracha before I eat, I'm gonna have kavana on the bracha, I'll daven more slowly, I'll think of the word, and you think of all the things from little to big that you're gonna change, and maybe later on you didn't change. Well, you know what? That doesn't make that much of a difference. By the way, don't get me wrong, it's better to change. But that doesn't make that much of a difference. Because the very feeling that you're standing in front of God with that sincerity, I mean, think about it. Another element of Rosh Hashanah is that in Rosh Hashanah there's a coronation. Coronation is that, you know, we are coronating God, which means we accept God as king. We accept God as judge. Which means the fact that we're standing there and accepting God as judge, that itself is an elevated religious gesture. This line of Ba'asher Husham, I think, is the reason. Again, the very starting point, God remembers Sarah. That's significant. But the fact that the day of judgment, and the judgment over here is Ba'asher Husham, that's something which is really quite significant. I will end that there's one other difference between the heavenly court and the earthly court, and that is that the earthly court, at least the Beit Din, does not take into consideration anything positive that you've ever done. Right? It only looks at the crime that you did. The Beit Din is unconcerned with any good deeds you may have done. It's not relevant. But when it comes to the heavenly court does look at good and does look at bad, and therefore the judgment is a much more complex judgment. But what I will say is that we see these two chapters, again, my phrase I used earlier is that they intersect. There's a connection between the two. How far you want to go with that connection, that's up to you. You can't avoid but seeing that they connect. But they both deal with the judgment. The story of the Akedah is the shift between death to life, Midat Hadin to Midat Rachamim. The story of Yishmael begins with God's Rachamim and then moves towards judgment. But it's the type of judgment that takes place there which is significant, which means even a Yishmael can cry, and God answers that cry, even if he's not even crying to him. That should give us a lot of hope, that if we cry and we reach out to God, that God will hear our prayers, but all the more so, that God judges us ba'asher hu sham. And therefore, in Rosh Hashanah, when you feel all the awe of the day, and you feel you're standing in front of God, and you feel that sincerity, that itself is enough to be successful in the judgment on Rosh Hashanah. I wish all of you a year of health, a year of prosperity, and a year of nachat from your children, your parents, and anyone else you need to.